Support for this episode of the podcast comes from our patrons at Patreon. Head to patreon.com/chasingEarhart to join the chase and become a patron today. On the morning of July 2nd, 1937, Amelia Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan disappeared over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. 81 years later, all over the world lie scattered pieces of their puzzle, waiting to be put together. Welcome to Season 2 of the Chasing Earhart Podcast.
As the frantic and fruitless search for Amelia continues, the world may not have heard the last from her. Within hours of her disappearance, distress calls are reported by professional radio operators and later by amateurs with shortwave sets around the Pacific and across the United States. Eventually, more than 100 reports come in, and the Navy and news media take them seriously, looking for clues. If Amelia is using her radio, she must be on land. To charge her batteries, she has to run the Electra's right engine, and it can't run unless the propeller is above water. On the night of July 3rd, calls apparently from Amelia are picked up by Pan Am Airways direction finding stations at Midway, Oahu, and Wake Island. Perhaps the most intriguing report comes from St. Petersburg, Florida. Betty Klenk was a teenager in 1937. She often spent the afternoon listening to her family's shortwave radio, which was hooked up to a powerful antenna. And she kept a notebook handy to jot down the titles and lyrics of songs she liked. One July afternoon, while searching the dial, she hears a familiar voice.
If you've been following the Amelia Earhart case at all in the past 30 years, you will know the name Rick Gillespie. A little over 1 year ago, we spoke with Rick for a little over 2 hours about the work that Tiger had done to that point in the island of Nikumaroro. It was a big show for us back then as we started out the podcast. Over the course of the last year, a lot of developments have been made in the Earhart case on multiple fronts and in multiple camps. Tonight, on the 53rd episode of the Chasing Earhart podcast, Rick joins us via Zoom from Tiger HQ to discuss Betty Klink's notebook, the radio distress signals report that Tiger released just a few days ago on what would have been Amelia Earhart's 121st birthday, and the reasons why he believes that the case of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan is closed. Joining us via Zoom is Rick Gillespie, the executive director for Tiger, the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery. Rick was a guest on the show way back on episode 3 last year, and now he's back to break down the latest developments in their investigation. Rick, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for your time today.
Hi, Chris.
Well, you've been busy, sir, over the course of the last year. And before we get into it here, can you give our listeners an overview of this latest report concerning the post-loss radio signals that was released just a few days ago on Amelia's birthday, just days before we're recording this interview?
Sure. Earlier this year, We put out a journal to our members called Tiger Tracks. And, it's time to put out a Tiger Tracks. What do we want to put? Well, you know, something that had been bothering me for a long time is the body of evidence represented by the what we call the post-loss radio signals, the radio distress calls that were heard for 5 days following Earhart's disappearance. The one call that gets everybody's attention is the call heard by a 15-year-old girl in St. Petersburg, Florida, Betty Klenk, who kept a notebook, and the phrases that she transcribed are just so emotional and poignant, and there are examples of what's known as occult information in there, things that Betty couldn't possibly know that are true. Betty's gotten a lot of attention. You know, unfortunately, she died, I guess it was last summer, but her notebook has been featured in documentaries, articles, and on and on. But there's so much more than just Betty's notebook. And I thought, how can I draw attention to the rest of the evidence? Because Betty kind of overshadows them. So I started to go through, and how can I present this stuff? And I said, well, we can have title graphs that show how the credible post-loss signals match the tidal conditions on the reef at that time. And maybe I should go through it reception by reception, because what a lot of people don't realize is that 88% of those receptions were heard by professional radio operators, government radio operators, not housewives listening to their shortwave sets. There were a few of those, but most of the signals were heard by Itasca, by the operators on Baker Island, by operators in Hawaii, U.S. Navy, and we need to show them. So I got back into it, and I started to put it together, and I realized, as often happens when you get back into a body of original documentation, you see things you hadn't seen before. And one of the things I quickly realized is that although we had known right along that the credible signals only occur, with very few exceptions, at night when the tide is low, it's not like they go on continually or randomly through those periods when she's able to run an engine to recharge the battery that the radio depends upon. The signals come in little batches. There's an active period of ballpark an hour, and then she's silent for an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours. Then she's back on for another hour or so. And it goes on like this until the tide comes back in or daylight comes and she has to stop. So there's got to be a reason for a pattern like that. And I don't know the reason, but we have a hypothesis that we're going to test. That is that we know that to recharge that battery, she has to run the engine at least 900 RPM. Now, Paul Mantz, her technical advisor, said that back on July 3rd, 1937, when asked about these radio calls and her ability to transmit. He said, well, she's got to keep that battery charged, and she can do it by running the engine at 900 RPM, and she'll burn about 6 gallons an hour. And in 2009, we went to Covington Aircraft Engines in Okmulgee, Oklahoma, and they put an R1340 Pratt & Whitney Wasp on a test stand for us with the same kind of Eclipse generator that Earhart used, and we verified what Matt said. Yeah, you can put a charge on that battery at 900 RPM, and you're going to burn about 6 gallons an hour. Fine. But I got thinking about that when I noticed this pattern. I said, but I wonder if 900 RPM is enough to keep that engine cool under those circumstances, or stationary. In a fairly, even at night, a fairly high ambient temperature. So I called the guys at Covington back up. And I said, what do you think about that? And they said, oh, no, 900 RPM isn't going to keep that engine cool. I said, well, how long is it going to take it to get too hot? Yeah, you know, after an hour or so, you're going to see cylinder head temperatures, oil temperatures getting into the red. You're going to want to shut down. Well, how long is it going to take to cool off enough to try again? I don't know, an hour and a half, 2 hours. Okay, that sounds like exactly what we're seeing. So we can test this experimentally, and we will. All I need is somebody with a T6, same engine. We'll park it on a ramp. We'll run the engine at 900 RPM and see what happens, and then see how long it takes to cool down. We can test this stuff. That's how you do science, you know. So that was interesting. And we saw other patterns and relationships. And I said, gosh, you know, we have more here than a rehash of old stuff we've been trying to talk about for years. This is really worth a major study. So we put it together as a complete study, give everybody everything they need to verify what we're talking about, and put it out there on Earhart's birthday. And because we have credibility with the media, they picked it up. That's how that happened.
And here we are. And as we get into it here, we'll make sure that we have links in the show notes to everything that we're discussing today. And those will, of course, be attached to this episode on chasingearhart.com. Now, you mentioned Betty Klink. We didn't get into her significance on your first appearance on the show, so let's do that now. For those that aren't familiar with her, can you tell everyone who she is, how old she was when all this went down, and what the significance of her notebook has been to Tiger as you've worked through your hypothesis over the course of the last 30 years?
Betty Klink I was 15 years old in July 1937, and her father worked for the electrical company, and he had rigged up a rather fancy antenna for their commercial home radio. It was kind of a high-end radio, and he rigged up a very fancy antenna. He wasn't a ham. He wasn't a licensed amateur. Neither was Betty, of course. She's just a kid who liked to listen to the radio, and she would spend a lot of time with the radio and cruising around on a shortwave dial, listening for foreign stations, foreign music, whoever she could get. She kept a notebook by her radio so that she could jot down the lyrics of her favorite songs, make notes about when different movies were playing, make sketches. So this particular afternoon, Betty was listening to her radio and cruising the dial, as she often did, and was astonished to stumble upon what sounded like Amelia Earhart calling for help, anguished calls for help. And Amelia was arguing with and trying to deal with a man who was with her who was acting irrationally. Betty grabbed her notebook and just started copying down the phrases she could make out. The signals came in and out, and they all weren't always clearly intelligible. But she wrote down what she could. And this went on for like an hour and three quarters, during which time her father came home from work and heard this, and I was excited about it, ran next door to his neighbor, who also had a radio, but didn't have the antenna set up that the Klinks had. And the neighbor couldn't get anything on his radio. Well, so her father came back when the signal stopped, when the transmission stopped. He said, well, we've got to get this word to the Coast Guard. And he took Betty's notebook, and he went down to the Coast Guard station in St. Pete and said, look, my daughter has been hearing these radio distress calls from Amelia Earhart. She's copied it on. I heard them too. You've got to get the word out. And the response he got was, yeah, people are hearing this. We're on top of it. Don't worry about it. You know, we've got it. And he couldn't get them to really pay any attention. And he went back. He was very frustrated. Betty was terribly frustrated. And for years, she tried to get somebody to pay attention. And everybody just blew it off. She wrote to Fred Gerner in the 1960s and said, look, I heard this stuff. I copied it down. Here are some things. And Gerner said, yeah, well, that's all very interesting, but there's really nothing we can do with that. And so Betty gave up. She kept the notebook, but she didn't try to get anybody to, she just gave up. So in 2000, we got some press, as we periodically do, and we got a call from Betty's neighbor, a guy named John Hathaway. And he said, look, I've got a neighbor. She's an older lady who has this story about how she heard Amelia Earhart calling for help and wrote down what she heard in a notebook. She has her notebook, but I'm not sure she'll even talk to you. She's so frustrated. But what she heard sounds like it matches what you're saying you think happened. So I went, well, you know, we'd like to talk to her and see if she'll share her information with us. So I talked to Betty on the phone, and she agreed to let me and my wife come out. They were in Illinois at the time. Her name was Betty Klink Brown at that time. Her husband was dealing with Alzheimer's, not in very good shape. We got out to Hopeston, Illinois, and spent several hours with Betty going through her notebook with her, videotaping the interview. Still, we have that available. And came away thinking, this really sounds legitimate. So Betty actually gave us the physical notebook to evaluate. And we checked the notebook. Yes, it's a genuine notebook dating to 1937. And all the other things, notations she had made in the notebook about songs that she'd heard, yeah, that all fits. You know, the notebook is real. we started looking at it and sharing it. And the more we did, the more people recognized what we did. That, yeah, this is an incredibly, almost too intimate picture of two people who are desperately trying to save their lives in a terrible situation.
Okay, and we'll return to Betty in a bit, but let's get into it and break this down. Now, to start this off, I'm going to quote directly from your report. Quote, early on the afternoon of July 2nd, 1937, the U.S. Navy office in San Francisco put an all-ships, all-stations bulletin out, announcing that the Earhart plane had failed to arrive at Howland Island and was presumed down at sea. At the time, it was assumed that the plane could transmit if afloat, so the Navy broadcast gave Earhart's primary frequencies and asked all parties to listen for her. So everyone's listening now for anything they can pick up that can be attributed to the Electra. They're listening on 3105, they're listening on 6210 kilohertz. The Itasca, meanwhile, has special permission to keep contacting Earhart on Noonan, and they continue to keep trying. At this point, anything heard had to be regarded as possibly being from Earhart on Noonan under these particular circumstances. So now I ask you, who was included in this group of listeners, and what did they hear?
Well, it was an all ships, all stations bulletin that the Navy put out, and that they put that out on the guard frequency that all ships at all stations always monitored. So anybody out there in the Pacific, in the Central Pacific, would receive this message. Ships at sea, land stations, anybody. And so there is no list of who received it. It was an all stations, all ships bulletin. And it would be up to them whether they wanted to tune up those frequencies and listen for them or not. Pan American did listen, but they were limited because their direction finding stations in Oahu, Midway, and Wake were also servicing the Clipper flights that were going across. And when they had a Clipper flight inbound, they had to be on that frequency. They had to take care of their own business. But when they weren't taking care of company business, they were listening too. And they heard signals and were able to take bearings on several of them. That's who was listening on the primary frequencies.
Now, you talk about accidental witnesses in your report. A lot of people will ask, how would it have been possible for there to be accidental witnesses in the first place? Can you explain how that would have been possible?
Sure. Yeah, it's not controversial at all. Earhart's radio, at the same time she's putting out wavelengths or primary frequencies, 3105, 6210, at the same time those signals are going out, the radio is also sending multiples of those signals. Not intentionally, it's just the way the radio was made. They're called harmonics, the higher frequencies than the primaries. Today, radios are shielded from doing that because you can't have all this stuff on those frequencies going out over the airwaves. But in 1937, radios weren't shielded like that. There was less concern about it because there was less radio traffic around to interfere with. And today, Earhart's radio would be called very dirty because it's sending out all these spurious signals on harmonics. Well, the thing about harmonics is that they travel much further than the lower frequencies. They travel in a direct line, like line of sight, but they also bounce off the ionosphere and can come down anywhere. It's not predictable, it's not reliable as a means of communication, but if you happened on that frequency in a location where those signals are hitting, you'll pick it up. And so what you had these people doing is cruising their dial, very much the way people surf the internet these days. People would just cruise their shortwave dials looking for foreign stations, other news, whatever. And they would be twisting the dial and suddenly they hear somebody talking and they tune in on it and boom, there's Amelia Earhart calling for help. And they're just astonished by this. Nobody, and their hearing are far better than the people that are listening on the primary frequencies out in the Pacific, because those primary frequencies are fairly short range. Her airplane, the radio was not intended for worldwide communication. It was just to communicate a few hundred miles to local airports and stations. And so what the people out in the Pacific are hearing on the primary frequencies are sometimes just a carrier wave. So somebody is transmitting on this frequency, and nobody should be. By law, it's a frequency that can only be used by U.S. registered aircraft trying to call a ground station. That's why Itasca had to get special permission. And sometimes they're hearing unintelligible voice. Somebody's talking, they can't understand what they're saying. That's not at all unusual with HF radio. If you've ever listened to HF radio, even when you've got a good connection, if atmospherics or something interferes with it, the signal can go to clearly understandable something, and you might recognize somebody's, they're saying, you know, that kind of thing. And that happened. The radio operator at Nauru, she had gone past Nauru on her way trying to find Howland Island the night before, and the operator at Nauru had heard her the next night when she had to be down. He hears these signals, and he can recognize her voice without the hum of the plane in the background. People out in the Pacific are not hearing, they're hearing a lot of calls that they think are her, but they can't get a lot of information from them. The people who are getting a lot of information are the people who stumble upon the frequency. And there's not very many of them. There were 9 credible receptions around North America. But interestingly enough, those 9 receptions, even though the people didn't know each other, didn't know about each other, they tell a consistent and deteriorating story of the situation. She's on a reef, the navigator's hurt, and then after the third day, she starts to be worried about rising water.
And that's a great segue into the next question. When you're working a case like this, and these people that had nothing to do with the search start coming out of the woodwork and start giving reports of them hearing something that they couldn't account for, and those all start to match up, how does that affect the hypothesis, and how do you apply that to the rest of your case? Where does that fit in?
It's in perfectly. The hypothesis is that Earhart was trying to find Howland Island, didn't find Howland Island. In trying to find Howland Island, she did exactly what she said she was doing, running on the 157-337-157 line, which didn't bring her to Howland, but did bring her to another island. And any port in the storm, she's low on fuel. She lands, and the only place there is to land on the dry reef that's smooth and like a runway, she makes a safe landing. And that's one thing we have a hard time. Everybody wants her to crash. She didn't crash. She made a safe landing. And she had to have, because she's sending these radio calls. And the only way the radio calls can continue night after night is if the airplane is on its wheels and she's able to run the right-hand engine that has the generator on it to recharge the battery. So this goes on until rising tides and surf wash the airplane over the edge of the reef, leaving her and Noonan, if he never made it out of the plane, literally marooned on a desert island, where she survives for a time, but eventually dies as a castaway at a campsite on the far end of the island, which happens to be the best place on the island for a castaway to hang out because of its particular characteristics. Her bones are found in 1940, 3 years later, misidentified by the British, and the artifacts found with her, parts of her shoe, parts of a man's shoe, the sextant box, because they're judged by the British to be of no importance, apparently get thrown out. We hope we can find them, but 3 expeditions to Fiji have not turned them up. I'm afraid they're gone. But we do have the British report, full investigation, that include the doctor's measurements that of the bones, which Jantz used to determine that, as you know, a better than 99% chance that the castaway was Amelia Earhart. So it's a very consistent story told by totally independent lines of evidence that are quantitative. These are documents, documented signals. You know, a radio signal, even though it's invisible, is a thing just like an artifact. And if it's recorded at the time as these were, it's a piece of evidence. You know, we put people in jail because of cell phone signals. We kill people with drones because of electromagnetic signal records. So this is hard evidence. And the bones are written, documented evidence from the time. This is quantitative stuff. The only mystery to me is why there's still a public perception among many that there is an Earhart mystery. Well, there's still more we can learn, and more we're trying to learn. We're going to continue to develop the data. Huge amount of data we've assembled in 30 years of investigation. But we know it happened. The only explanation I have for what resistance there still is among the general public to accept this is the general problem we have in society these days of rampant science denial. Science denial is climate change, vaccinations, evolution. You can go right down the list, and that's the problem. All we can do is put out the hard evidence. Fortunately, increasingly, it's being accepted.
Now, the commanding officer of the Itasca dismisses all of these reported post-loss signals. Why do you feel he was so dismissive?
Oh, well, you're asking me to ascribe motivation, and I never met Warner Thompson. I know I've read a lot of what he wrote, and I know that his report is largely what is often known as cover your butt. America's sweetheart aviator had disappeared on his watch, and he was very concerned about that. The whole episode had been terribly embarrassing for him. There had been no search plan formulated before Earhart disappeared. So when she did disappear, he's totally unprepared. He's making it up as he goes along. And then there was this horrible incident on July 5th where the Navy radio operator at Wailupe in Hawaii gets this fragmentary code message that they interpret. It's very poorly set code, and it's just phrases, and we don't know how to break down the phrases because they didn't break them down. But it said 281 North Howland, call KHAQQ, beyond north, above water, shut off. And Thompson interpreted that 281 North. They're floating around in the water calling for help 281 miles north of Howland. That's what that means. So off he goes with the Itasca, chugging along there, and he reports back to Coast Guard headquarters in Hawaii, said, okay, we interpret her to mean that she's in the water 281 miles north. We're headed that way. Press representatives are hanging over the shoulders of radio operators in Hawaii, and they hear this, and, oh, okay, they hear her. They're on their way to rescue her. And it's getting dark. It's coming nighttime. And on the Itasca, they're getting close to this place, 281 miles north of Howland, and they're looking on the horizon, and somebody sees what they think is a flare. Wow! So they send a radio message that is heard in Hawaii. We see your flares. We're on our way. Well, the press picks that up, and everybody goes crazy. And Itasca is getting inundated with these calls. Offers for exclusives, for photographs of the rescue, the whole thing. And then they get to this place, and of course there's nothing there. And they get a message from the guys back at Howland Island saying, yeah, we see those things too, they're meteors. And the whole thing was just such an embarrassment. And So when it's all over and everybody's headed home, they've got to explain all this. And the radio messages that everybody at the time thought were quite convinced were genuine hang over this thing like Banquo's ghost. They've got to get rid of them. And so they make all these allegations that, yeah, these were investigated and found to be hoaxes. Well, yeah, there were some hoaxes, but they were passive hoaxes. We've seen no evidence that anybody was out there transmitting signals pretending to be Earhart. The hoaxes were people saying they heard something they couldn't possibly have heard. So they had to get rid of the messages, and Thompson's report misstates all kinds of stuff. I go through it in the report, but demonstrably false statements. George Putnam and Paul Mantz didn't buy it for a second. They were absolutely convinced that she was out there on an island someplace and she'd been left to die. And they tried for years to raise the money to do their own search and were never able to do it. So really what we've done is kind of pick up where somebody should have picked up back then.
Now, we talked about this a bit in your first appearance a year ago, but I'll ask you again now because I think it's important. Regarding Gardner Island, was there a flyover during the search, and did they ever deploy any ground crews to search not only Gardner, but any other surrounding island?
No people were put on the ground at any of the islands. The only islands that were searched were the islands of the Phoenix Group. Well, no, that's not quite true. The Itasca also went over into the Gilbert Islands and called at several of the Gilbert Islands and made inquiries. They didn't search, they asked people. But the Gilbert Islands were densely populated, and they were British colonies, so that was easy. For the Phoenix Islands that were uninhabited, except one of them, they did put three airplanes from the battleship Colorado over the islands searching for an airplane, because they knew that in order for these signals to be genuine, there had to be an airplane on the ground and on its wheels, so they ought to be able to see it. By the time they get to the Phoenix Islands, the airplane's gone. So they look down, they don't see an airplane. They do see what the senior aviator described as clear signs of recent habitation. But they were under the impression that all these islands had native work parties harvesting coconuts, white supervisors. And they weren't terribly surprised to see signs that somebody was there. They couldn't get anybody to come out and wave to them. So they eventually decided no one's home. And they left. The island was crossed off as having been searched. And that was the end of that. Now, the next island they searched that afternoon was Hull Island. And there was a coconut operation there. So when they fly over Hull Island, they see huts and they see natives standing on the roof waving shirts at them or something. And so the senior aviator decides he's going to land in the lagoon, John Lambrick. He lands his float plane in the lagoon. Now, he can't taxi up to the shoreline because on all these islands, the lagoons are common enough to land on if you can avoid not hitting the coral heads. But you can't get close to the shoreline because it gets too shallow. So he's sitting out there in his O3 U3 Corsair. The white supervisor comes out in the canoe and talks to him. And, you know, the guy is just, where on earth did you guys come from? You know, this airplane has landed in his lagoon. And he says, well, we're looking for Amelia Earhart. You're what? You know, he had no idea Amelia Earhart had disappeared anywhere. He had a radio. This is a funny story, Chris. John Williams is his name. He had a radio, and it could only send code, and he used it to communicate with his superiors. But back in June, this is July, back in June, there was a solar eclipse out there. And he knew there was going to be a solar eclipse. It was well known. And he was having trouble with his workers. His workers didn't want to work on Sunday, and he wanted them to work on Sunday. So he told his workers, he says, if you don't work this coming Sunday, he knew the eclipse was coming on Monday. If you don't work on Sunday, I'm going to block out the sun to punish you. And they said, yeah, right. And they didn't work on Sunday. So on Monday, sure enough, a dragon eats the sun. And they figure the only way he could have arranged this was with that radio he uses. And they stormed into his radio shack and beat the living daylights out of his radio. So his radio was out of commission until it was replaced in August. So the Hull Island radio cannot be a source of post-loss radio signals suspected of being from Earhart, and that's why he didn't know anything about Earhart. So Lambrick takes off, and they search the other Phoenix Islands. They don't land at any of the others. And they just say, well, those signals had to come from an airplane on land. We've looked on the land. There's no airplane on the land. Therefore, somehow, those signals must have been bogus. And the rest of the Navy search, once the Lexington aircraft carrier shows up, takes place in open ocean looking for floating wreckage, life rafts, finds nothing. And at the end of it, they say, well, she apparently just ran out of gas looking for a tiny island in a big ocean, sank without a trace. We never stood a chance of finding her. So we didn't do anything wrong, but we got to head home.
Do you think, I know it's speculation, but at the time that if they would have landed on Gardner, if they would have taken that same approach and actually landed on Gardner, you think they would have found Earhart and Noonan alive at that point? Or do you think that they would already have succumbed at that point? I know it's speculative, but based on your research, do you have any idea how they would have found them?
We can only speak for Earhart, whose remains were found at this Castlewood campsite, along with food remains, burned fish bones, bird bones, turtle bones, that indicate she had been alive for certainly weeks, maybe months. And the Navy overflight happened just a week after she disappeared. So, yeah, Earhart was still alive. We can't speak for Noonan. We don't know what happened to him. But Earhart was there someplace. If they had landed at Gardner, the only place to land is in the lagoon. But he'd have the same problem he had at Hull. He can't go ashore and poke around. All he can do is sit out there on the lagoon. Now, if she was someplace where she could get to the shore of the lagoon and wave to him, that'd be great. But we have no idea. We don't know where she was. If she was back in the shade, as any sensible person would be during the day, it can take 10 minutes to get out to the beach through that dense vegetation. I know. I've been there. I also know that if you're on that island and an airplane comes over or a helicopter, if they're low, you don't know it until they're right overhead because there's so much ambient noise from the surf, from the trade winds. You don't hear them until they're right overhead. You don't hear them coming. If you can imagine being on that island hoping for rescue, seeing an airplane or airplanes show up and fail to see you and leave, now you know you are screwed. Yeah, it would be horrible.
So, Rick, you have D.W. Hoodless examining the bones found on Gardner and determining them to be male. And then you have the commanding officer of the Itasca dismissing the post-loss signals, attributing them to something other than what you've determined that they are. Is this whole thing just a case of certain people in certain positions making the wrong calls?
Sure. It's mistake after mistake after mistake. As I often said, there's a lot. It's not a mystery. It's a mix-up. And you can see the errors. It's more difficult to ascribe motivation to the people who made the errors. We know that the captain of the Itasca had kind of a bad attitude toward the whole thing. It was never his idea to support the Earhart flight. This is something he was assigned to do. We got this Earhart flight, and we're supposed to send her the weather and signals that she can home in on. That's what we're supposed to do. And we deliver the people who have fuel for her and are going to greet her and help service her airplane. That's our job. For the British, that whole story is just an amazing case of administrative, almost intentional head in the sand. You've got the High Commissioner in Fiji who is suddenly presented with this situation where a junior officer in one of the most remote parts of his domain out there in the Central Pacific has found what could be the remains of America's famous lost aviator. And this is September 1940. The Battle of Britain is going on. England stands alone against Nazi Germany. Churchill is desperately trying to get Roosevelt, to get Congress, to provide more support. The American public is still very isolationist. It's a very delicate time diplomatically for Sir Harry Luke in Fiji to contact the Americans about this. Means he's going to have American press all over him, going to have to deal with the American government. And he says, no, we're going to keep this investigation right here within Fiji. We're not going to send the bones down to the anthropology department, the anatomy department at the University of Sydney. We're as was recommended, we're just going to keep it right here. And so Hoodless, who is the principal of the Central Medical School, which was not a medical school in the way we think of a medical school. They didn't train doctors. They train native medical practitioners, first responders, if you will. But Hoodless didn't have any specific training in this. But he looked at the bones, applied the formulas available to him, and misapplied them, we know that, and came up with a conclusion that it was a short, stocky man. Well, that was good news. Now we don't need to worry about contacting the Americans. We can just forget about all this. And exactly what they did. And that whole incident disappeared. The file wasn't intentionally hidden or anything. It just ended up in the file, along with all the other records of the Western Pacific High Commission. It disappeared like the Ark of the Covenant and the last scene of Raiders of the Lost Ark. Until we found the file, tracked it down. 10 years took us to track down this file in an obscure archive in England. And then we had the whole thing that, yeah, really did happen. And we had Hoodless's report and his measurements. And then it became very apparent what had happened.
What, I guess that brings us to, we're going to wrap up the interview here, but that brings us to two final questions. The first one is, what is next now? You guys have put out this report. You had the Jantz report come out a couple months back. What is next for Tiger? Are there more island visits to Nikumaroro? Are you guys, is it primarily a lab thing now? Do you feel like this is sort of solved in your eyes? I know it's not in the general public, as you talked about earlier, but is it solved in your eyes? Have you done everything you can do? What's next for Tiger at this point?
Oh, we're still developing data. Whether we go back to the island or not really depends. The most important thing that needs to be done is a really conclusive manned submersible search for anything that remains of the airplane. It's very expensive, a couple million dollars, and with no guarantee of success. We've done enough out there to know that there's no huge piece of airplane wreckage sitting there easily found. Whatever's there is going to be very hard to find if anything survives. Everybody talks about, well, what you need to do is find the plane. Where is it written that a little airplane that goes into the surf in a dynamic reef environment 81 years ago still exists? Yeah, there are World War II vintage airplanes in lagoons all over the place, and some of them are in very good condition. But I've never been able to find an example of any aircraft that ended up in this kind of environment, ocean environment, on a reef slope that gets hammered by storms, that has still survived. Whatever remains of that airplane is in little pieces, scattered, and maybe buried on that reef. Maybe there's some big chunks. That'd be great. But until somebody steps forward and says, here's a check, go look, which we'll do if somebody does, I think the case is solved, but there's more we can learn. And we're still working on that, both from a forensic anthropology standpoint and the Voiceless Radio standpoint. There are more there's more work we need to do with some of the artifacts. We're still developing the data. Dr. Jansen and I are still working together. I think you're going to see more peer-reviewed papers about this. We're going to keep going as long as there is data to look at and work to be done, just as we've always done.
Rick, originally, Tiger was hesitant to get involved in this particular project. You talked about that a year ago on our show, that you originally didn't want to have anything to do with this. Now, a little over 30 years later, do you ever think about the direction that Tiger might have gone had it chosen not to get involved in the Earhart project?
Well, honestly, no. We got involved in it reluctantly. If our initial investigation had not revealed that, wait a minute, this looks like there might be something to it, it's worth pursuing, we'd have walked away from that. We'd probably have concentrated more on the mystery of the white bird, which I'm very impatient to get back to. I think there's a lot more to be done there, and I think there's a chance that we can wrap that. What we've proven to be good at is original source historical research, and it's open source. It's through our members. It's not me. It's the people we've attracted to the organization, the historians, the scientists, the forensic experts, and the everyday people who have a great capacity to slog through the detective work and look for the original source material. It's just a powerhouse of research capability. And it's my job to take the results of that research, help direct it in what we hope are productive avenues, and present that information to the public for them to react to any way they want to. It's not up to me to tell people what happened to Amelia Earhart. I have to show them what we have found, what happened to Amelia Earhart, and they can accept that or not. It doesn't change the fact. Everybody's entitled to their own opinion. They're not entitled to their own facts. They can interpret facts any way they want to with their own opinions. All we can do is present the facts. It's up to everybody else to decide for themselves.
The website is www.tiger.org. Rick, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for sitting in on the podcast.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Chasing Earhart podcast, part of our Castaway retrospective series. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Come back to ChasingEarhart.com each week for another new podcast. While at ChasingEarhart.com, visit our archives and our blog to hear all of our past episodes and interviews with guests such as Brad Meltzer, Tom Vinson, Candace Fleming, Jessica Cox, Abigail Harrison, and Shasta Ways. You can also hear interviews with representatives of all of the relevant hypotheses regarding the disappearance of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, such as Tom King, Dick Spink, Gary LaPook, Rick Gillespie, Andy Sherrill, and more. Also at our site, you can find hundreds more posts, project updates, and much more information regarding the life and disappearance of Amelia Earhart. The Chasing Earhart podcast is a show without any sponsors or ads. We rely on support from listeners like you to keep the Chasing Earhart project operating. You can donate to the show, and as our thank you, receive bonus podcasts, merchandise, and advanced opportunities for Chasing Earhart events. Find a full list of available shows and rewards at patreon.com/chasingearhart. You can also follow the project on social media, where our team posts all of our shows, news, and project information. And that hashtag is @ChasingEarhart. The Chasing Earhart podcast is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by Tom Myers. Podcast music is provided by Dane Jarrus Schmidt, and narration is done by Forrest Burgess. The opinions on Chasing Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. Chris Evan Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All movie clips and audio used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of historical education, and no infringement is intended. The Chasing Earhart podcast is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. The Chasing Earhart podcast is a Chris Evan Films production. Copyright 2018. All rights reserved.